to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly. Since at least the 1950s, but probably dating back to the turn of the last century, San Francisco has been a place where art and politics have collided. For 11 years, from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s, the crucible for much of this cross-pollination was a collective space known as Commotion. It was an artist collective, performance space and recording studio, art gallery, and really, an ethos. It was the breeding ground and incubator for such now-famous musicians as Michael Franti's Disposable Heroes of Hypocrisy, Primus, and Consolidated, while providing a nurturing venue for bands like Operation Ivy, Los Sensontles, and Green Day. The Mission District-based Commotion eventually fell victim to the code wars of the 1990s, engendered by waves of gentrification, yuppification, and the dot-com bubble, and its story reveals much about a changing city. Last week, I had the chance to sit down with two of the co-founders and prime movers of Commotion, whose two bands, world beat pioneers The Looters and the new wave Big City, birthed what would become Commotion International. Matt Callahan, who's now based in Switzerland, is a musician and the author of The Trouble with Music. And Robin Ballinger is the chair of the Urban Studies Department at the San Francisco Art Institute. When I spoke to them, I started by asking Robin what made Commotion distinctive in her estimation.
Well, Commotion was an artist collective and performance space. We had tremendous energy, I think, coming out of different music scenes, including punk and also world music at the time. And we joined up with other artists in all different kinds of genres, from, you know, film and visual art, performance art, spoken word. And at that time, it really did relate a lot to San Francisco at the time also. In many ways, it was a very radical and lively place. And Commotion became, you know, a place where, you know, we did a lot of benefits, where there was direct sort of, you know, political kinds of organizing and action taking place. But a lot of it was around the arts. And there wasn't really a kind of separation at that point either. And it was a lot about putting ideals into practice very directly. I would say that we were, you know, loosely influenced by anarchism. I have to qualify that by saying that what we meant by that was always something that was very group-oriented and collective. It wasn't really about sort of, you know, individualism in a kind of Eurocentric way, but more about, you know, let's sort of start our own little mini society and organize it this way and produce the kinds of events and ideas and possibilities that everyone kind of believed in. So,
and how did Commotion relate to different forms of art? I mean, you mentioned music, and yet it was a space for more than music. So how did that fit into this philosophy that you're touching on?
I think it was really driven by the musicians in many ways. Again, you know, everyone wanted to have a space that was very diverse, I would say, you know, diverse stylistically. That's, you know, one thing I was thinking about on the way over here was the fact that Commotion has not been actually written about. It sort of doesn't exist in history books on, you know, punk and so forth, because, you know, we had a lot of, you know, punk shows there, but nobody wanted to only do that. So we didn't become known like Gilman Street or something as like a punk venue. We had people play there from all over the world, literally from, like, you know, the Philippines, from Central America, from South Africa, from the then Soviet Union. It was kind of remarkable for a semi-legal club to do that. But so we just incorporated all the arts. And I think we tried to do a lot of, you know, pretty experimental things. We would do these, a lot of times we would deliberately put together different types of programming that you would think wouldn't work at all. Like, we'd have like Buñuel films followed by MDC. it was hilarious. I remember one night there was these kind of young punks came in, you know, to see MDC, and the films were still on. And at first they kind of had like this attitude, like, you know, what is this crap? And then suddenly in the film, like, some, you know, really normal looking guy in a suit like kicked a poodle or something. they instantly sort of got it, that, oh, okay, this was kind of punk-ish in attitude. It was just that it was a film, you know, by some avant-garde filmmaker. So
right, way before their time.
Right. And we were about really challenging all those kinds of boundaries and sort of, you know, pointing out the commonalities, you know, in ways, I think.
And yet Commotion wasn't just a space, although it was that, but it managed to reach people who were not in the Bay Area through these sound magazines. What is a sound magazine?
Very early on, we decided to record the the concerts. And part of it was simply a continuation of all the things Robin just talked about. You know, in other words, recording itself was simply an extension of what was happening there. I don't think we necessarily viewed it as we're making a record of this, we're archiving this. It was actually to hear what it sounded like. And to the idea was to actually put out cassettes at that time or vinyl records. I mean, the intention was actually to take what's happening here and make it available to other people. So it was not in the sense of like archiving or anything like that. So that's one thing. In other words, it's an art form in itself. Recorded music is an art form. So, you know, you had this, from the beginning, an attempt to integrate all these different art forms from, you know, actual fine art to or visual art to performance art to recorded art to literary art and somehow bring them all together with under this radical perspective or the umbrella of radicalism. So that was the genesis of the Sound magazine. There were a few years before we actually made a Sound magazine. But I have to say that we were definitely ahead of the curve on that one because everybody followed us after that with that. I mean, I don't take any great credit for it or something. I'm not trying to toot our horn, so to speak. But it is a historical fact that nobody was releasing music with printed matter until a couple of years after we did it.
There were a huge number of groups that went on to be quite famous that we recorded, and the recording quality was really high. I think, I mean, even though Matt said we had sound engineers involved, I mean, most of this we did ourselves, figuring things out. But because you had musicians actually producing the space, I mean, we made a fantastic stage. We were sort of like, hey, we're musicians, what kind of stage do we want? We built a huge stage that was, you know, really solid and excellent for performing. And so the whole place was really designed, you know, by musicians, for musicians, and for audiences, obviously. But, in the very early, early days, for example, Primus played many of their first gigs, actually at the first Commotion even, before anybody knew who they were or cared. And it's kind of amazing because all the people that were musicians, you know, instantly recognized, I mean, especially like Les's talent as a bass player. But for a long time, they really had no audience until I think they finally got some airplay and then it sort of took off from there. But we had, you know, and so we were able to make, you know, what probably someday will be a pretty amazing archive of, you know, a lot of performances, even, you know, Green Day, Chumbawamba, John Trudell as a spoken word artist. There's Michael Franti, huge numbers of people. I mean, there are people that, besides music, that have gone on to do important things. Mary Liz Thompson, actually, she and Daryl Cherney just released a movie recently that's called Who Bombed Judy Berry? Mm-hmm. And she was involved in Commotion, mm-hmm. you know, centrally for a long time. And at that time was involved in Redwood Summer. She had footage from that time. And she actually went with the Looters when they were invited to Nicaragua in 82, the first mm-hmm. U.S. band to play there after the revolution, and filmed a lot of that whole trip. And she had also spent time with the autonomous movement in Kreuzberg. Filmmakers that have now gone on to, and everyone should see that film, by the way. Yeah, a lot of different people.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about a legendary and yet in some ways little known, if that's possible, art and music space in San Francisco called Commotion. It existed from 1986 to 1997 and left its mark in many, many ways. I'm joined by two of the founders of Commotion, Matt Callahan and Robin Ballinger. Matt is author of The Trouble with Music, and Robin is the chair of the Urban Studies Department at the San Francisco Art Institute. So how, Matt, was Commotion actually funded? You know, you described it as semi-legal. What was its status, official or unofficial, within San Francisco, and how did it manage to do what it did for more than 10 years?
Three things come to mind to answer that question. First of all, when we initially kind of got together, we were sharing rent amongst bands who would have been paying rent anyway, meaning for rehearsal space. And we all shared the desire to have the rehearsal space be big enough to simulate a real concert stage and also enable us to have parties, which would in turn raise money to defray expenses. Then the Looters got signed to Island Records, and we got a for what for us was a very big advance, but it was actually just a normal record industry advance. And so we took a big chunk of that to build the stage and in the new place when we found the new place. So that enabled a number of things that we probably couldn't have done without a big chunk of cash. But from that point on, it was the events themselves that largely sustained the place. We had four events a month as a rule, sometimes more. And then there were, at different points in time, people making some donations. Although, remember, all along, people were paying rent. The bands who used the place to rehearse in really sustained it, if you want to talk about the foundation. But the income that was generated by the parties or the events was, you know, it's probably 50-50. In fact, when at its peak, when it was actually at its most successful, we actually had an office. We could sustain the rent of an office because we couldn't have the office in the building where the events were taking place. So we were actually generating enough income not only to pay for that, but we also, it was sort of our rule that the only person who got paid was the janitor. The person who had to clean the toilets got paid.
Yeah, it was run by all volunteer labor, but we did feel like, you know, almost everyone sort of was getting something out of the space at the same time. Or, I mean, even if it was just the, you know, feeling like you're making a contribution, which is obviously important, but literally, I mean, cleaning the floors and the toilets or whatever had, like, sort of little sense of value personally. So that person was paid, and that was the only person that was ever paid, I believe. Mm. It's really important to mention, too, though, that pretty much almost every show we ever did was a benefit. In hindsight, it was very small sums of money we made, but people also really appreciated it. It was also about raising awareness of various issues. We did benefits, for example, for needle exchange when it was still illegal in San Francisco, for like battered women's shelters, for all kinds of different causes. And we would take a, you know, very small amount just to kind of help cover our expenses and so forth, and then, you know, divide it however we worked it out with people. You know, we really believed in, again, sort of just putting a lot of principles into action around, like, trust rather than contracts and so forth. Almost everything we did, you know, didn't involve any paperwork. It was basically on trust. And but, you know, we did an enormous number of benefits for different groups over the years.
Well, Commotion didn't come out of nowhere, and understanding it really seems to necessitate understanding the history of art and politics in the Bay Area. And you, both of you, come out of different moments, let's say, in Bay Area history. But starting with you, Matt, you're actually born in San Francisco, unusual mm-hmm. in that sense, a mm-hmm. red diaper baby. Mm-hmm. And the late 60s, of course, were a time of a great flourishing of politics and art and culture here in the Bay Area. How do you relate that time when you were quite mm-hmm. young with Commotion, which came, you know, decades later? Is there continuity? How do you understand it?
Yeah, I think there is continuity. There's also breaks. I mean, I think at the time, I mean, I can look at it now and sort of analyze it differently because I'm older and see the whole thing from a different perspective. But at the time, I think it was a combination of recognizing that, you know, a big change had occurred in San Francisco as a result of, you might say, the demise or the decline of the 60s or the end of the revolution. Certainly, you know, the way the music industry functioned, it's the total co-optation of the whole thing by Bill Graham and others. That was already done by the time the Looters started in 81.
And maybe actually you should say who Bill Graham is.
Well, he kind of monopolized the live music scene in the Bay Area. I mean, it was very difficult to play anywhere without playing a Bill Graham venue, without his approval. And of course, it's not just him, it's Bill Graham Presents, it's an organization, but he was sort of the institutionalized structure that not only survived, but profited from the 60s.
And yet also came out of it, right? I mean, he got his start in the San Francisco Mime Troupe.
That's right.
Which, you know, was a very radical space.
Right. But I think to make the link, I mean, I think it was kind of, for me, a combination of, like, sort of having graduated out of that and seen, you know, the kind of the limitations of that, and then being inspired by, on the one side, music from other parts of the world and also New Orleans. I was always interested in black music, so it was kind of like that was my thing as opposed to rock and roll. But then it simultaneously being turned on by the Sex Pistols and the Clash and realizing that this was rock and roll of a new type. It was breathing new life into this dead form, and inspiring a whole, let's say a half generation, not a full generation, to rebel. And so I could really relate to that. And so even though musically I wasn't doing the same thing, I was interested in the same scene and the relationship of do-it-yourself, organizing your own concerts. I mean, it was kind of like, we start this band because we want to play music. We enjoy music. We have parties. People are coming to the parties. We're having a great time. Then we go out to try to get gigs, and we can't get a gig. And instead of being humiliated by the way the music business operates, we just said we're going to do it ourselves, which was in keeping with the whole DIY ethic of the punks, you know, and Mabuhay Gardens and so on and so forth. And at that time, we were actually kind of tolerated, even though musically we were not in the same thing, but we played the Mabuhay.
Which was a famous punk venue in North Beach.
Right, exactly. So, I mean, it was kind of, at that time, it was still open. You know, it wasn't so rigid and purist in a musical sense. I mean, the punk scene.
You mean between genres?
Mm-hmm. Between genres. It was still relatively fluid. There was a definite style of, you know, guitar chords and bashing. But it wasn't so rigid. It wasn't like you couldn't do the two. For one thing, there was always this merger coming from London and Jamaica of reggae. You know, so the reggae was always involved with punk in those early stages. And so the Looters actually played reggae and were sort of followers of this strange river, which ultimately led to a mixture, which we meaning the Looters in Big City, ended up naming World Beat, although we weren't, evidently, it was coincidental with a guy in San Antonio, I think, Dan Del Santo, who also came up with the name World Beat. But anyway, whatever. The point is that was sort of like our synthesis of all these different influences that were in parallel chronologically with punk. So we were definitely related to punk, but on the other hand, we were separate. We didn't want to be confined by any musical genre. And I think that was, you might say, the continuity with the 60s, to return to that point, was that the 60s was characterized, particularly in San Francisco, with this wild melange of sounds. So you could have Dr. John, the Charlatans, and Thelonious Monk on the same bill. We carried that forward. Instead of, it's all going to, you know, the Buzzcocks and the Damned and Sham 69, we didn't program performance the way it had become, you know, the norm to do.
So you drew on that kind of ecumenical tradition.
Exactly.
of the 60s. Now, Robin, you come out of punk and new wave. What was that scene like here in the Bay Area, and how did Commotion ultimately relate to it the following decade?
Well, I was going to add to what Matt was saying, because for me, especially the early days of punk and new wave, the word punk actually meant a really wide range of sounds. It had nothing to do with sort of three chord hardcore. I mean, there were tremendous numbers of people that were doing really experimental types of, I mean, some of it was just like performance art, but it was still punk in a sense. I sort of originally got into punk through free jazz, ironically. I was into experimental classical music and free jazz, and this might sound like a terrible cliche, but I literally remember, the day somebody played the Sex Pistols for me, and it kind of changed my life. Can't believe I'm saying this on the radio. But later I thought about it, and in certain ways, going from, you know, Cecil Taylor to the Sex Pistols wasn't that big of a leap.
Sure.
On a certain level. And also the politics of it just was like immediately appealing. And I think coming out of, I grew up in San Diego originally, and San Diego in like the mid-70s, the music, you know, in general was just horrible. It was sort of like the most, you know, mainstream stadium rock, like completely vapid, you know, uninteresting musically and politically. So hearing the Sex Pistols was just like, you know, a shock and something I'd never heard before. And I really related to the radical politics in there and the kind of just the energy of it. From that point on, literally, I sort of got involved and, you know, moved to San Francisco in 79, lived in the Mission District, you know, for 20 years after that, or through that entire period. But I started a band called The Appliances, which we never became hugely famous, but we opened for a lot of people, we did a lot of things, and actually we have an album coming out soon from 1980. I'm kind of afraid about that, but The Appliances actually combined, you know, actual appliances. It was sort of experimental, and it sort of had a punk attitude, but was incorporated early hip-hop, really early, because we had one of our performers, actually, Dominique De Prima Baraka, had grown up doing spoken word in the New Eurekan Cafe on the Lower East Side in like the late 70s. And she was in our band. So we were doing like rap in 1980, which was, you know, pretty early. And there was also, I mean, it's actually important to mention hip-hop in terms of the Looters' influences too, because people kind of forget that early new wave or punk and hip-hop had a lot of relationships together, especially, you know, when it was still, both scenes were pretty underground still. Anyway, so the Appliances came out of that. We actually opened for U2 on their first tour with Romeo Void. I know. People are always amazed when I say that. What was funny about that, actually, is I remember, like, we were not impressed with U2 at all, because we were like, these guys just sound like a rock band. Like, what's the big deal? Because at that time, there was so much creative stuff happening, you know, and I don't know. Of course, we didn't get it. But anyway, so the Appliances were involved in all that. And at a certain point, I became really interested in world music, actually, and kind of shifted focus a bit towards Big City. And my musical partner there, Joe Gore, who's gone on to be fairly famous as a guitarist, he's toured with PJ Harvey and so forth, he and I started Big City, actually out of meeting each other, I think, in African music classes, and where we spent years, like, you know, learning the styles really well. And he's a great guitar player, so, and I played bass in that band, and we co-wrote the music. But actually, I met Matt and the Looters when I was still in the Appliances, though. So, but the scenes were all close together, I guess, at that time.
It is interesting to think about, you know, why the Bay Area has been this place, going back decades, that has produced or has allowed for spaces or allowed for people to create spaces like Commotion and allowed for such a vibrant scene. I mean, one only has to think about actually this institution, KPFA, which was known at some point for experimental music, and then actually Maximum Rock and Roll started mm-hmm. as a program That's on right. KPFA, led to the founding of Gilman Street, mm-hmm. which is, you know, maybe in some sense, I don't know if it would be fair to say the equivalent of Commotion on the East Bay, but in itself, and of course still going, legendary punk rock venue. So these sort of odd connections coming out of strange places, crossing over. I mean, do you have a sense if the Bay Area has lent itself to this sort of thing more than other places?
Well, it certainly used to. I don't know, with the advent of the computer industry, whether it's possible in the same way that it was, but it's certainly historically true.
And why, then?
Well, and that's a long story. I mean, I think, in my own view, it starts with Isadora Duncan and Tom Mooney, you know.
You're talking about
the modern dance and the labor movement.
This is the turn of the 20th century.
Right, but it goes up right through, you know, the 1934 general strike and the ILWU. It's the only part of the country that really kind of weathered the McCarthy era with the CP intact, the Communist Party intact, and not completely discredited, and on down, right down through the 50s and the 60s, this influence was rather unabated. Whereas in New York or Los Angeles or other places, it was interrupted, broken, smashed, crushed, Hollywood 10, whatever. And I think there's also some other elements about the San Francisco that people have probably forgotten, and it's pretty hard to believe in some ways, that San Francisco was a small city. And, you know, there were only 2 million people in the 60s. And
In the Bay Area.
It hadn't even grown that much by the 80s. It exploded in the 80s. That's when it really, with the whole computer industry and so on and so forth, that's when the population really expanded so rapidly. And that makes quite a difference. The impact of sheer numbers, the impact of a declining industrial base, the fact that you didn't have a port anymore now as compared to then. You know, I mean, this really affects the cultural life of a city in ways that you can't, it's hard to quantify as, like, you know, but what I remember towards the end, you know, going out playing in local clubs here, and most of the people who were coming into the clubs were wearing suits and ties in places that used to be considered hip because they were all conventioneers at the Moscone Center. Do you know, and they were all there for the Apple World show or whatever it was. This was a change, and up to that point, you know, we'd play at the Paradise Lounge or Slim's or half a dozen other clubs, and it would be a local audience that came to see us. And that was, by 97, that was definitely different.
Right. We'll discuss all of that in great depth in a moment. That's the voice of Matt Callahan. He is one of the founders of Commotion, which we're discussing today, a legendary art, music, space in San Francisco. You're listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. We're going to take a music break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio, found online at kpfa.org. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today we're talking about politics and art and the importance of spaces, which are diminishing everywhere, in which politics and art can come together. We're discussing the history, which is still to be written, of the space and concept, I guess, Commotion, which existed in San Francisco from 1986 to 1997 and brought together legions of musicians and artists, some very well known, some less so, and was a place of enormous ferment. I'm joined by two of the founders of Commotion, Robin Ballinger and Matt Callahan. Matt is the author of the book, The Trouble with Music, and was a member of the Looters, which played a very important role in Commotion. And Robin Ballinger is an anthropologist, also co-founder of Commotion and member of the band Big City. So, Robin, tell us about the track that we just heard.
The track we just heard was from the Bedlam Rovers, who was another one of the bands that was very important in the entire development of Commotion. They played a really important role musically. They included people that had carpentry skills, which was really important. It was kind of like a mini society in terms of realizing that, you know, having people that knew how to do something with plumbing was just as important as people that knew how to do recording engineering and so forth. So we had a diverse group that had, you know, sort of multiple skills. But that song, Sewer, I like that a lot. It's quite a radical song. I think it relates a lot to what's been happening with the Occupy movement, actually, because it's very much about the corporate elite. The Bedlam Rovers were a great band.
So, Matt, what were the problems that bedeviled Commotion? I mean, any attempt at creating a space within society that is radical, that has a different philosophy, that has a collectivist ethos, and that may sometimes find itself on the wrong side of the law, is going to have problems. Some of them are external and some of them are internal. What were the problems, internal and external, that Commotion had to grapple with?
The primary problem was the state, because the fire department and the police department were not only against us in principle and against us in terms of their, you know, specific rules or laws that they had to police, such as how many people can be in a building and how many exits you have to have, but also their general attitude. In other words, there were very few police who were going to be sympathetic to what we were doing or how we looked or our, you know, so in a sense they're prejudiced against you to begin with, whether or not you meet the requirements of the law. So that's an obvious thing, but it was also the state in general, because there was no way to get any kind of funding. There was no way to, you know, we as we developed and realized we're going to be around for a while, we did try to write grants. We went to various foundations that were supposed to be funding the arts and so on and so forth. We could get nothing. And we were often turned down as just being there was a certain attitude that somehow you're not respectable enough to deserve money. So that to me is the state as well. It's not the state in the form of a policeman or a fireman or the government, but it's the state in terms of who controls the funding, who controls the authority, who determines what is aesthetically beautiful or what is valuable to society. Internally, I'd say that the problems are rather, you know, you might say common in the sense that all artists, and for that matter, political groups share certain internal dynamics. I think in the case of Commotion, we were probably laboring under certain delusions about the music industry, which were fueled by a general naivete, meaning I don't think there were many musicians who really understood what the music industry were doing. And since we, meaning the Looters, had been beneficiaries of the music industry, in the sense of literally getting money, it was kind of like, it was easy to be naive and to not realize that actually these guys are against you too. And they're not going to come to your aid as, you know, members of the music community to support Commotion. No way. The only support we ever got in that sense was Gilman Street, our sort of sister club, who did a benefit for us when we were really up against the wall.
I wanted to add that, certainly there were a lot of problems, but I also think it's really important to point out what, you know, a lot of the positive things that we did. I mean, internally, basically, you know, without following any official, like, health or safety regulations, we just really took care of people in that space. And for 10 years of running a space like that, we had almost no problems or injuries or anything, which is actually remarkable. We developed really, I think, very smart strategies for dealing with security, which were actually kind of humorous because instead of having, you know, big bouncer types or something, which actually tend to aggravate situations, we actually would sort of use gender strategically. Basically, if some, I don't know, typically a guy maybe drank too much or there was some issue, we would just sort of get a couple of cute girls to come up and sort of, you know, I don't know, just kind of put their arm around him, sort of talk to him. Before he knew it, you know, he was sort of being ushered out of the space and then he was out. It actually worked incredibly well. So we did, I mean, again, because we cared about the people there, you know, we didn't need people, you know, we didn't need the official regulations, and the space ran really well. We trusted people with money. We had people around the door that were, you know, handling money, and we didn't, and never, to my knowledge, never had any problems with that. I frequently worked as the house manager there. So, yeah, it was, I mean, I think it just goes to show that, you know, it's sort of like when people care about each other and the environment they're in, they can do a lot. And all those, you know, the rules and regulations are kind of unnecessary. That's actually kind of a big difference between our space and Gilman. I realize that they had different issues and they've lasted longer and they were underage, et cetera. But, I mean, we had no set of rules, you know, posted on the board when you came in. It was sort of the opposite of that, actually. We really tried to avoid any sort of codification of rules and regulations.
Just to add one element of that, the other thing that people listening need to understand is that the way we operated was collective meetings. So, again, you know, whatever label you want to put on it, I would be very skeptical of it, whatever you call it, anarchism, communism, socialism. These labels don't really describe what actually happened, because what actually happened was more of an outgrowth of the way a band functions. In other words, bands are collectives. And so all of us have been in bands of four or five, even six, seven people. And so we knew how you had to get people together to discuss, what are you going to play? What's your repertoire? Well, we were discussing the rent and who's going to organize the next event. And people were coming to us as we became more well-known and asking to play. Yeah.
We even had like open booking meetings, basically, where the public was invited to come once a month. And it was great, actually, because, you know, I mean, people are under this illusion now that, you know, nobody was able to coordinate anything before the internet. But people actually would come down and somebody would say, like, oh, I have a band that wants to play. Somebody else said, you know, oh, I was really hoping to organize a benefit for such and such organization. Somebody else would say, you know, oh, I have this film. And all of a sudden, that was the event. The benefit would hook up with the band, with the film, and we often did food there as well and tea and whatever. So it worked out, you know, really well. And we also, you know, kind of really encouraged people to sort of take action on their ideas rather than just sort of presenting ideas for some hypothetical other person to do. Sort of like, you got an idea, organize it, do it. So,
well, I want to return to something that Matt said, Robin, which was about the end of Commotion and running up against the police and, mm-hmm. and the fire department ultimately saying, you know, you can't do this. There were a number of spaces in the 60s and 70s, some were collective in to varying degrees, communal spaces and so on, that ended up disappearing over a period of time that has been characterized by some of the code wars, that regulations were used to mm-hmm. close these things down. How would you situate what happened with Commotion within that larger trajectory?
You're absolutely right on that. I think that I mean, it's kind of ironic. I mean, I think what really shut Commotion down was towards the end was the fact that the easement between our building and the other building was 6 inches too narrow, which is, you know, just ridiculous in many ways, because like I said, there was an easement, there was space, we had two exits even, all those things. And again, like I said, we actually developed our own safety measures, which worked incredibly well. But yes, the code violations are exactly what, you know, were an indirect way to shut down spaces, and that is what happened. We did have a couple of famous incidents where there was like a riot of 300 punks in front of the place. That didn't help either, but no, I think it was really the kind of the code violation that, what happened was after the code violation, we couldn't advertise our shows as publicly, because for a while we were actually, you know, advertising in the Bay Guardian. I don't mean advertising. We had our shows listed in the Bay Guardian and so forth. And after that, then basically we couldn't do as much above ground publicity. And that's really what kind of started to suffocate the place. We could only, the programming actually kind of shifted at that point towards more only sort of local alternative bands, because we couldn't do the bigger touring groups and such.
I would add that also, I mean, there is in the life of any kind of loosely organized collective going to be an ebb and flow. Bands go on, mm-hmm. people go to school, people, you know, their own lives change. It's oriented towards young people. And I don't mean the musicians. I mean the bands that played, because there were lots of bands of all different kinds. But I mean the people who were actually running the space and the people who were members of the thing tended to be younger. And so as you get older and you want to do other projects, or you're going on tour, you know, the Rovers got somewhat successful, and so they were away all the time. And the Looters for a big chunk of time, too. So these things happened, which I think are natural in the course of an artist collective, and maybe unique in that sense, as opposed to a political collective or a commune that's actually organizing, say, food or baking bread or something like that. But I would say that this code, not only was the code thing kind of relevant, but it was also that we weren't necessarily in any position to do anything about it, even if we had known. But I don't think we were that aware or that cognizant of the fact that San Francisco itself was changing. And that's very important to keep in mind, because this might have gone on longer in another city. It's possible. I don't know. I don't want to speculate about it, but it does make a difference, because it comes back to your question of why here. The very things that made San Francisco so attractive to artists also attracted yuppies and gentrification and all the rest of it. And they were really creeping in, which goes back to something else that Robin said earlier that I think is quite important, that we were definitely part of the North Mission community. That's the thing that protected us more than anything else. We were supported by, like, mission groups. So when we were under attack by the police, you know, the local doctors and people like who saw that we were doing something for youth considered that, like, hey, this is a plus. We need these people. So we were actually supported by local community groups, not as some sort of interlopers coming in, you know, white kids from the suburbs to take over this and be bohemians. It's like we lived there. This was our community. And, you know, over time, people supported us. But, of course, the community itself changed.
Commotion, as I said, was always very diverse in terms of who was involved in the programming. We you know, had many spoken word artists from the mission, like Alejandro Murguia and Alfonso Texador. You know, a lot of different people in, like I said, Native American communities performed there. We did benefits for, you know, Patrick Hootie Croy, a lot of, you know, people that don't get a lot of attention. So we, you know, I think generated a lot of, you know, goodwill, and there were a lot of people involved from all kinds of different communities there.
Against the Grain is the program on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and we're talking about Commotion, a performance space in the Mission that lasted from 1986 to 1997. And I'm joined by two of the founders of Commotion, Robin Ballinger and Matt Callahan. Well, in the time that we have remaining, I'd like to talk about those changes to the Bay Area that have really altered this area as a space for projects like Commotion. When do you sort of date these changes happening, particularly in the area that Commotion was located? And how did these processes play out, not just for Commotion, but other places and cultures that were radical or bohemian? Because it's clearly a complex question, as you touched on earlier. It's not simply that processes of gentrification happened entirely separately from these efforts. In some ways, the efforts of artists played into the process of gentrification that transformed the area.
Right. First of all, as far as dating goes, I think that the changes became, you know, very, really apparent by the, I would say, 94, 95. It was becoming very apparent that things were going to change and that we were up against a lot more than just the cops and the fire department, which we would always have been. You know, I mean, that's sort of a constant, but that there was pressure on rents and there was pressure on people wanting to use the space, that old factories that were around us were closing down and being converted into lofts. And this was already happening there. So it was quite clear that you know, there was something going to happen in our area, our zone. So that's one thing. The other thing is that I think that as far as this dynamic of the artists go into a slum and turn it into an attractive place for professionals or management types or whatever, that is extremely complicated when it comes to the mission. It's generally true. It's certainly a pattern of urban development throughout the world, certainly in Europe and North America. But the North Mission or the mission as a whole is a very complicated story. It going back to the origins of the city, up through the 50s and 60s, and this the dynamics of immigration, you know, where all the Central Americans moved to, the immigrants that were working in all the restaurants that were fueled by the you know, the computer industry boom and you know, financial boom and all that stuff. So you've got this strange dynamic of you need these people to wash your dishes, to make the place you know, nice, attractive to the rich or to the affluent. And meanwhile, we're in the middle of that, going to a place that it was much slower to be turned into a yuppie land itself. It was really only towards the end of the 90s that it became, you know, like impossible to find a place to park on Valencia Street or mm-hmm. impossible to get into a restaurant on a Tuesday night. You know, it was that late that it was like really apparent. And that combined with the internal effort or the internal things going on within the group of Commotion to mean that the only way we could have sustained it would have been to somehow become legitimate and actually have grants. We just couldn't sustain it. So you could call that economic pressure on the one side, just sheer money. Where are you going to pay? The rent hadn't been raised, but still the costs of retrofitting the building, possibly buying the building so we could stay there. All these issues came up. You know, and we didn't have those resources. We were still basically poor when it comes mm-hmm. down to it. I was driving a taxi, you know.
Me too.
So I mean, you're dealing with real poverty as opposed to, well, let's go and ask Dad for some money. I mean, it's kind of like we were there. That was our neighborhood as well. And there wasn't much choice, in a sense.
There were organizations like Cell Space, actually, that were directly influenced by Commotion. And from pretty early on, they... I mean, I think they really appreciated the spirit of what we were doing and this and that, but they were much more organized and sort of grant-oriented than we were. I'm not saying that's good or bad, but different type of organization and structure. I was going to say, you know, in my own memory of the mission in San Francisco, I think people tend to think that, oh, well, things always change. But San Francisco was kind of the same for 20 years. I mean, the 20 years that I lived there between 79 and 99, it was really kind of, I mean, the same in a good way. It was, you know, really vital culturally and politically. And then, again, sort of towards the later 90s, it just changed radically. I mean, it was actually... almost unrecognizable from, I mean, especially the mission. Like you said, literally restaurants that were considered terrible that nobody would go in were now like full of, you know, yuppies drinking margaritas and stuff. I would walk down the street that I lived on for 20 years and just like almost not recognize the neighborhood.
How do you assess the political consequences of that change? I mean, obviously it was a change to who inhabited a place, mm-hmm. but how did it change life for those who stayed on, who didn't leave?
I mean, first of all, I think a lot of people were pushed out. Let me just say that first. I mean, that's when people started talking about Portland becoming the new San Francisco or whatever, because people moved to the East Bay or they moved to other places because literally they couldn't afford it anymore, and it didn't support, you know, sort of cheap spaces where you could do a dance studio or do, you know, music studios and so forth. So a lot of people literally got pushed out.
And that process is continuing again in quite an accelerated way. I mean, there's a whole sense of people leaving San Francisco to Oakland for relatively cheaper rents.
I know. I was part of that, too. Moved to the East Bay for exactly that reason. And, I mean, and now, I mean, Oakland has become a pretty vital place. I think it's more like San Francisco was in some ways. I mean, obviously, it would be different for different people. But, I mean, some people continue to do well. Counterpulse, I mean, basically came sort of out of Commotion. In fact, Commotion did have a really loose kind of nonprofit status, which was called Baycat, which became Counterpulse, and Chris Carlson was involved in that. But I think that, you know, you'll see in all those organizations that they did have to become much more legitimate in certain ways. I mean, legal and sort of go for nonprofit funding and you know, arts funding. So I suppose it was kind of, it's more on the informal level of what we were able to do that's probably much more difficult, both financially and legally and so forth. I know other people, you know, that have had a really hard time actually with this change, that have stayed there in San Francisco, who, you know, continue to kind of believe in recording what's happening there and chronicling that, but find it really pretty depressing actually, because it's not the same place, it's not the same community, it's I mean, it's the same name, but it's very, very different in terms of kind of what it means in the world, I think.
Mm-hmm. And what's the importance of public space for culture and politics? I mean, this is a question that has been raised by the Occupy movement. One could perhaps argue, well, different forms of resistance change over time, different forms of culture. Why should we care about being able to have spaces to bring people together?
Well, obviously there's a fundamental answer to that, which is that without the public space, there is no public. There is just private. Everybody owns whatever. Their bodies, their atomized space, their little computer screen or whatever, and they can, you know, be proprietors instead of proletarians, you know. But the fact that public space is where actually everything really happens, in the sense of society, in the sense of creativity, in the sense of people sharing their experiences, their hopes, their aspirations. It's obvious why the clampdown on the public space would be absolutely crucial, particularly at a time like this, where capitalism is in its death throes, and you know, you want to make sure that the slaves stay in their place. This is why public space is so important, because it's on the one hand, you need it. You've got to have a, you know, Union Square. You've got to have some sort of pretense of society, but you have to police it. And what we were trying to do in our limited and very, very small way was to actually undermine the public space by creating an alternative public space. So since we were not allowed to have a public space by the law, we created a place that was underneath the law, and that was, by underneath, I mean, we were not in direct confrontation with the law. We weren't protesting. We were creating a space that sort of evaded and avoided a direct conflict with the law, even though we were constantly running this interference with it. So you have this kind of strange situation where the very existence of things like Occupy or the very existence of something like Commotion is a damning condemnation of public space as it exists within capitalism, within this state. Because we're saying this is the way it could be, and it could actually be a lot better if the public could really support this and could actually participate without fear of being arrested or beaten or, you know, in some other way harassed by the authorities. And so you're kind of holding up a mirror. In our case, we're artists, so we're literally kind of acting out, if you want to say. When we're standing on a stage performing, it's not the same as a political act where, you know, masses are marching in the street or you're actually overthrowing the government or something like that. But we're demonstrating, in a way, what is possible, in the at least in the imagination.
Well, finally, let me just ask if in this moment, which is a moment of political ferment, of people coming together in different ways, or at least thinking about coming together in different ways, Do you think that another generation of people should really have a stab at trying to create these new sort of spaces? Maybe not exactly in the model of Commotion, or maybe, but are you hopeful that new things can come out of what you've been describing as pretty bleak years leading up to this?
I haven't participated in a lot of what's happening in Oakland, for example, but I hear that it seems like there are, I have gone, you know, obviously to the Art Murmur and those kinds of things, and it does seem like there's a lot of great stuff happening, and I think that I think a challenge would be to not make it generational so much, but to be much more inclusive and to think about, you know, different populations. And I've been, you know, incredibly impressed with the diversity, you know, that's been happening in the Occupy movement too, and the kind of conversations that people are having just across, you know, seemingly really different kinds of identities and so forth. So that's, I think that's really encouraging, and that's something very different. I don't think, I think the punk movement and a lot of those movements were based in kind of a youth culture. And I think that, you know, what I see now is in some ways even much more inspiring than that.
Matt Callahan, Robin Ballinger, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
I've been speaking with two of the founders of Commotion, an art and music space which existed in San Francisco from 1986 to 1997. Robin Ballinger is an anthropologist. She was in the band Big City, and she is chair of the Urban Studies Department at the San Francisco Art Institute. And Matt Callahan is a musician. He was a member of the Looters, and he is the author of The Trouble with Music. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you can find on-demand and downloadable audio, and it's the most reliable way to sign up for our podcast. You can also call us at 510-848-6767, extension 670, or visit us on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. I'd like to thank our engineer today, Erica Bridgman.